Raidieraksts drošinātājs.
So first of all, I assume that many of our listeners in Latvia or Latvians abroad know what a vatnik is, but some may not. And how do you define this word? What is a vatnik?
So in my book, I describe vatnik as someone who supports and or spreads Kremlin narratives. Kremlin's main narratives. So what this kind of definition, what's I think it's important to mention there is that you can spread these narratives even if you don't support or believe in them. You can do them completely cynically to, for example, to get engagement on social media or be paid or whatever. So, but basically it's people who support and or spread Kremlin main narratives.
So, but basically there, like you said, there are cases when people are not aware that they are spreading disinformation. Well, mostly I guess they are aware, but there are also cases when they're not aware and that they don't understand that maybe this or that topic is Russian disinformation.
Yeah, definitely. Especially the further away you go from Russia, the more common it is. It's many of these narratives, they are often tied to this kind of worldview of anti-NATO, anti-America, especially anti-United States thinking. And of course, like a lot of these narratives being spread very intelligently by the Kremlin for decades already. So kind of strong anti-NATO sentiments have been there for a long time. And still one of the most persistent false narratives is that NATO or the US Secretary of State James Baker said that NATO would not expand eastward, which is basically false narrative. But many of these narratives can go way back, like for example, many of the conspiracy theories, some of them are over 100 years old and or even older.
Well, this project you have launched is called Vatnik Soup. What made you choose this name and what is it that you do within the framework of this project?
So with Vatnik Soup, my main goal is to shed light on Russia's main narratives and also on the people who spread them online. So my background is in research of social media and disinformation. So it kind of felt natural for me to start investigating these people who are spreading the Kremlin's narratives online and then write about it. So it started in October of 2022, around 6 months, 7 months after the full-scale invasion started. And somebody suggested the name to me. It's just an anonymous account on Twitter told me that you need a hashtag. Everybody should have a hashtag. And they suggested Vatnik Soup. And I thought it sounded good. It sounded nice. And then I thought, okay, I'll go with that because soup is very easy to digest. And I kind of always thought that my writings are this light, kind of lighthearted, easy to read summaries. So it felt like a soup. So Vatnik Soup.
And soup, maybe we can, I don't know, refer to the disinformation itself. I mean, well, there are, like you said, many different kinds of narratives. They are spread all over the place. So it's a kind of messy like soup when you have different ingredients in there.
Definitely. And it's not a very tasty soup, if you think about it.
Yeah. Please give me and our listeners maybe examples of who are these people that you are referring to as Vatniks. Who are you? Yeah, what are those people?
So they come from very different backgrounds. There are people who are, for example, former military, Scott Ritter from the United States, Douglas MacGregor, both have often been commenting on Russian state media. Scott Ritter has been visiting Russia several times until his passport was taken away. There are politicians like, for example, Gerhard Schröder from Germany. There are so-called independent journalists who often turn out to be just pro-Kremlin propagandists. So they claim to be offering kind of different perspective on these things, but it's just basically Russian propaganda and denial of war crimes such as Bucha and Kherson. In general, like bombing of children hospitals that Russia has done in Ukraine, these people are usually kind of denying these events or blaming the Ukrainians, for example. But they often hold a very biased view of the war about Ukraine. The one interesting thing is that almost everybody in Vatnik Soup, they almost never speak about Russia. Because once they start speaking about Russia, if you start stating facts about Russia, you can quickly see that it's not really this kind of conservative fortress that it claims to be, or like the holder of traditional values and so on.
So in a way, they are trying to hide that they are spreading narratives that are common Kremlin rhetorics, yes?
Many of them are, not all. I mean, there are even, I also have written about many Russians who are spreading or funding channels that spread these narratives. So it's a very mixed group of people. And of course, you can clearly say that, for example, Margarita Simonyan, the head of RT and Sputnik, is not really trying to hide what she is, but she is still actively funding and spreading these narratives. But then, of course, you have these people who claim to be, for example, they politically left-wing, and then they claim that they only want peace, they only want the war to end, which is a nice idea, but once you start asking about on what terms the peace should be, so should Ukraine cede all these regions that Russia is now temporarily occupying? So they usually become quiet.
And what about these strategies that these Russian propagandists use? What can you say?
So if you go through the main narratives, it's usually that Russia is always the victim. So Russia has never done anything bad. For example, I think there are Russian officials who have said that Russia has never invaded any other country and so on. And it's NATO expansion that is causing all this. And NATO is threatening Russia's sovereignty and so on. Another big narrative has been the blaming CIA for everything. So whenever there are big protests, for example, that were in North Africa a while back, and of course Ukraine, Orange Revolution, Euromaidan, Georgia, that those are organized by the CIA. That is a very common thing, common narrative. In general, it's this kind of, they are blaming the so-called Anglo-Saxons for all evil that is. Some are often present, but also when they are, for example, invading Ukraine, they come up with new stuff, and usually it's blaming the government for being fascist, for example, because that's a narrative that works really well inside Russia, because they fought the fascists in the Great Patriotic War that they call World War II. So it is very effective narrative there.
And I guess there are, you know, differences in how this disinformation affects things. For example, if it is expressed by a politician, then he can influence politics in the country. If it is expressed by an ordinary person, then he influences public opinion in some part of the society. So there are, you know, you can influence different kinds of groups or processes within the country.
Oh, yeah. And even propaganda works on different levels. So there are these very kind of simplistic conspiracy theories like the bioweapons labs, for example, that was at the beginning of the full-scale invasion, that was very popular. And then there are these more complex issues like, for example, NATO expansion, that there's a lot of politics involved and so on. When it comes to high-level officials, the latter works really well. So we can even see that from the current Trump administration. So you look at the Intel chief, Tulsi Gabbard, the Minister of Health, or what, Secretary of Health, Robert Kennedy Jr., and J.D. Vance, all of them have been echoing these narratives of NATO's expansion and Russia being provoked to the war in Ukraine. So they have been they've been spreading for a long time, and now we finally see their effectiveness, because they are now being echoed by the highest officials in United States. So Russians have been extremely good at spreading these narratives.
And your content can be found on various platforms. I see that you joined Twitter or X in April 2022, so shortly after the full-scale invasion started, and you mentioned that the project was launched in October. Why did you have this idea to create such a project and talk about these issues at that time? How did you felt at that time, when few months in the full-scale invasion? What made you do this?
Well, first, I think we have to go way back to around 2014 when Euromaidan happened, and I was using social media, but I was using different kind of social media. I was using this maybe a bit more extreme, even radical social media websites like 4chan, where already Russia was actively spreading these narratives. So I could say that I was even a victim at some point of Russian propaganda. And only later I realized that these same narratives are being spread after the full-scale invasion started. But I quickly also realized, have you seen the movie Groundhog Day? So in the movie, there's this guy who has to leave the same day over and over again. Like every time he goes to sleep, he wakes up and has to leave the same day again. So I felt like this. I felt like I'm seeing all the stories, same stories every day. So I got interested in who is spreading these stories, because it's just the same things coming over and over again. And I realized that it's not really that big of a group. And I thought that I would create this kind of archive of these people so I can then debunk. I could use this kind of archive or these writings as a way to debunk these narratives. And it quickly became quite popular. And then after some big investigations, it became extremely popular. And I'm still doing it today. And we're actually publishing a new one today, or I am publishing a new one today. So it's still an ongoing project.
Yeah, I see that there are a lot of information that are you posting every day. And as I understand, you not only expose propagandists in the Western world, you also expose propagandists in Russia and elsewhere in the world. Is it mainly, I don't know, the Western world and Russia, or is it also different kinds of regions further away in the world?
Of course. I mean, China is a very big player in all this, and AI is definitely changing the whole scene. Chinese AI controlled, massive kind of automated systems are already out there, and we don't really know the scale of it. Iran is a very big player still. They have a lot of these so-called troll farms, so people who are just promoting Iran's political message online. Of course, Saudi Arabia has been a big player for a long time. So there are, I would say that most countries have some kind of, let's call it, propaganda leg. Of course, it's not just Russia, but we talk about Russia so much because they are the superpower in all this. They are probably the best and they understand this system the best. But as I said, AI is now changing the whole playing field.
How much, in your opinion, is the so-called old Europe aware of Russian disinformation? You spoke about this a little bit earlier. Are they able to understand who is spreading Kremlin propaganda, or they are just simply thinking that they say, I don't know, those things that are, you know, some kind of simple solutions for the things and different kinds of narratives, but that they are not coming from Russia?
Yeah, old Europe, the like Italy, Spain, France, Germany.
Yeah, the Western.
Yeah, they are mostly unaware. They are not very educated on the matter. And I think we already saw this around, I think it was 2014, when these right-wing conservatives had a landslide victory in, you know, like anti-immigration parties in the European Parliament, Salvini, Le Pen, and so on. And there's still a lot of Russian narratives that are being freely spread in many of these countries. But now it's interesting because Donald Trump and his administration are kind of supporting the same policies in many ways. So, for example, Donald Trump has been talking about the Spanish far-right party Vox lately, just mentioning them. So there is a good chance that both Russia and the United States will kind of start influence operations or foreign or interference operations in these countries, like we saw with Elon Musk doing in Germany, for example. And of course, also, he's been talking about Romania, he's been talking about UK, and so on. So this will be a big challenge to these countries. So how will they tackle this kind of foreign influence coming from people like Elon Musk, or influence operations that are supported by Russia's disinformation machinery, which is huge?
Do you see that we have the tools to counter this? And by we, I mean, I don't know, the Western world, the Europeans, I don't know, European Commission, the United States, or whatever. Where do you see those chances to counter this Russian disinformation in Europe, but also, you know, the Russia is trying to gain influence all over the place, including, for example, I don't know, Africa. So Europeans have to be there as well, at least in some way. So how do you see those efforts there in place, or there are maybe not in place fully right now to counter this?
They are not in place. That's the harsh truth. Mm-hmm. If you look at the resources, so for example, Russia is using $3 billion annually just on in Russia, inside Russia, on national media. That excludes RT, Sputnik, all these kind of covert operations, 3 billion euros. EU is using maybe 40 million. So you can quickly see the asymmetry there. So the problem is that still in the EU, we don't really consider it to be that big of a problem, because if we thought that it was a bigger problem, then we would actually commit resources to this, to fighting it. And once you compare like 3 billion to 40 million, you can quickly see that it's a losing battle. And when you think about war, so always before conventional war, there's information war. And I've been saying for years now that we are at information war with Russia, and we are losing that war because we are not committed to it.
And well, on the other hand, we cannot like fully influence those, for example, social media companies, right? So Facebook and X and so on. So that's why there are those fights between Europeans and Americans. So do you see some kind of hope that we can some kind of, I don't know, do something with these social media companies, because this disinformation is, of course, hugely spread there?
I mean, there's always hope. We should never lose hope. And I think ultimately, when it comes to information, it's mostly about who tells the better story, who tells the more compelling story. And stories don't have to be lies. They can be true stories. We could speak more about the good things about, for example, the EU or the Western liberal democracies and the collaboration between these countries. So I think it ultimately comes to the who tells the better story. And for a long time, the better story, the more interesting and more compelling story has been coming from Russia, because they are very good at telling these stories. But I think there is a lot of potential still in Europe to tell very good stories and kind of change minds, hearts and minds in this situation. But I think we are still in kind of deep slumber in the EU. We haven't really woken up to the reality of the situation. There is war in Europe, and it might actually spread to NATO countries. It could spread EU and NATO countries. So there is this danger, but I think we now would be the time to act. And that's unfortunately still not happening quickly enough.
Returning back to your project, do you know what kind of people follow your content and from which countries? I guess you see at least something regarding this. So what are your audience, maybe, let's say?
My biggest audience actually comes from the United States. Around a fifth of my followers come from the USA. There are other countries, big countries, UK, Germany, Canada has been growing lately now that Trump has been threatening the Canadians. It's a very mixed group. A lot of Ukrainians also, of course. It's a mixed group, but also, like, if you look at who are the people following me, there's a lot of journalists, there's a lot of politicians, policymakers, but I would say that most people are just regular people who are interested in how to fight against Russian disinformation and propaganda. So it's a very mixed group. So former presidents, current presidents, politicians, and then just, you know, regular people.
Since the Americans are your biggest audience, can you say that Americans are more aware of disinformation right now? They are more educated now? I guess maybe after the Russian influence in American election, they only started to pay attention to this problem, let's say. So what would you say, how far they have gone right now in this field of being aware of disinformation also in their continent?
So there is a small group that in the United States that understand the severity of the problem, but there's also a very large part of the population who has no clue and who outright deny this kind of. So right now, Donald Trump has basically since 2016 saying that Russia is not doing any disinformation or propaganda operations in the United States. And this is basically, this has become a very official thing now that he's become the president for the second time. And right now in Washington, D.C., you cannot even basically use the word disinformation or anything related to that. So they are kind of neglecting the whole thing on the highest level of the of government. So it's actually a very alarming situation. But I feel like there is this small part of the population who are aware of the problem and understand how it has become one of the biggest problems in the United States. But I think the problem with America is that it's extremely divided society, and it's just basically half of the people support the Democrats and other half the Republicans. And sometimes it feels like that the only thing that they want to do is kind of to attack, actually physically attack each other. So it's actually a very divided society.
I found an article in which you say in 2023 that, in your opinion, Elon Musk can also be called a Vatnik. Why do you think that?
Well, there are many reasons for this. I would say that his kind of decline has been, in the last 6 months, it's been much more steep. But even in 2023, I think I was one of the first people who publicly stated that Elon Musk is kind of carefully promoting Kremlin narratives. And for I think it started right after the annexation of these four oblasts by Vladimir Putin. So he annexed Zaporizhia, Kherson, Luhansk, and Donetsk. And then a lot of these kind of peace negotiation proposals started going online. And Elon Musk was spreading one of these, which was very pro-Kremlin, in my view. And he even used some terminology that is basically exclusive, like only used in Russia, like Khrushchev's mistake. So there were a lot of these signs that he is kind of switching sides in this debate. But I think we still have to remember that he initially gave Starlink to Ukraine, which has probably been one of the biggest game changers, positive things for Ukraine. So we should always remember that. But of course, later it became this government thing. So I don't think Elon Musk is no longer involved in that so much.
One more thing about Americans. What would you call or how would you characterize Donald Trump, considering that he has been criticized for being, let's say, too nice to Putin?
Well, he's in my book, so I'm not going to call him a Vatnik, of course. So he's featured in the book, and most of his like close associates are also there. So I don't know. Maybe I am in danger by saying this, but anyway, I think the signs have been clear also with Donald Trump. So when you look at how often does he criticize Russia or Vladimir Putin, there aren't many cases where you've actually seen him harshly criticize. And so far, when you look at the peace negotiation process, there has been a lot of demands for the Ukrainian side, but there hasn't been any demands for Russia or Putin. So I'm optimistic. Maybe once Trump realizes that Putin is not interested in peace, maybe they will start helping Ukraine big time. But so far, the signs, I think there are a lot of these kind of signs that Donald Trump is just a regular Vatnik.
Okay, and we spoke about your audience. What kind of feedback do you receive from your work? I guess it is not only good words. There are also bots and trolls as well, and bad words towards you, if we say politely. What is the feedback?
I would say that it's mostly positive. Sometimes you can clearly see when you are spreading story that the Russians don't like, then usually the bots and these bigger accounts start attacking you very aggressively. For example, if you say that Europe should unfreeze the Russian frozen assets and send them to Ukraine, or seize the assets, this is when they usually become active. When you start talking about money and assisting Ukraine, they become extremely active. But I would still say like it's 90% positive, maybe even 95. So I get a lot of positive feedback. I think I'm already so used to the negative ones that I don't really care anymore, and they don't really affect me anyway, unless it's some like real threat. But that doesn't really happen
How many people in Finland follow you and listen to what you say? How, let's say, influential are you there?
I would say that I'm quite influential. I have also, of course, a strong opposition, often coming from people who support Russia or this kind of Finnish Russian friendship thing. Many of them support Vladimir Putin, but there are also a lot of people from all levels of the society who support my work. And I mean, my book is coming out in Finnish in next year, so publisher thought that would actually be a viable economic option to publish the book. So I think there might be an audience for this. I think it would also do well maybe in Latvia. So if there is a publisher somewhere out there who wants to publish, let me know.
Yeah, well, of course, we speak a lot about this information in Latvia. Of course, I think it would be interesting. And can you tell us how widespread Russian disinformation is in Finland? What are the narratives there?
It's not really widespread because it's not very effective. So if you compare, for example, Finland and Latvia, we don't really have Russian-speaking minority. In Finland, it's very, very small. Either way, we had some mega vatniks in Finland, but one of them now lives in Moscow and other person left for Eastern Ukraine already, I think, in 2015. So there really aren't that many people who have big audience and who are spreading programming narrative. But I've been talking about this very often, that we are also kind of protected by a few things. One of them, of course, it's the shared history with the Soviet Union, invaded us in 1939 and again later. Also, our education system is, I would say, in this regard, it's one of the best in the world. So we teach about media literacy, critical thinking. We start that at very early age, even at preschool. We talk about what are the consequences of lying and so on. We have this very good system that is into education so that people are more informed. But I still feel like the biggest challenges for the Finnish society are the same as for everyone else, is social media, this kind of, well, media that's like always changing, the ever-changing landscape of modern media. It's not so static anymore as it was before.
So there are vatniks in Finland, but there are not many, yes?
There are, yeah, just a handful. I would say that there is one who is maybe a slightly influential. His name is Tuomas Malin, and he's a doctor in economics. But even him is just, I would say that, quite marginal. So not many people really know about him.
European countries have, to a greater or lesser extent, but stopped or reduced cooperation with Russia in different areas. How would you describe Finland's current approach towards Russia, for example, if we speak about the border, when we speak about the circumvention of sanctions? Where do you see when you can say, yes, this is a good work, and where can you say that we got more work to do here in Finland in this or that regard?
I think the general policy towards Russia has been positive. It's been good. Like, it's when there's a country that invades another country in Europe, there should be harsh sanctions. There should be a lot of consequences for this invader. And I think Finland has been very good at imposing sanctions and enforcing them. Of course, there are examples of, like, I think in most countries, or circumvention of sanctions, people still are interested in making money by doing business with Russia. So they'll do basically anything to continue business as usual. But I think most Finnish companies have been very good at kind of changing strategies, changing business strategies so that Russia is not involved in them. And basically, we have eliminated Russian fossil fuels already, which is a good thing. But of course, we did a lot of collaboration, for example, in nuclear energy. Russia was helping us a lot to build nuclear plants and so on. So now, if we want to do this kind of projects in the future, we need to find new collaborators. But I think I would say that Finland has been very good at kind of pushing Russia away from our sphere.
And do Finns feel safer now when they're in the NATO? Are there some, you know, notion or sense of this? How are you feeling right now?
I think we did feel relatively safe a few months ago or a month ago, but now with Donald Trump, I think everybody's kind of questioning, or well, not questioning, but asking questions what the future will hold for us, because it seems that Russia is not going to stop. They are still, their economy is still very much focused on the war. So everybody's just kind of asking questions. So who could be the next target if Ukraine falls?
We like to think that in our region, by which I mean the Baltics, including Finland, Poland, that we understand Russia better, we understand Russian disinformation better. No secret that Russian propagandists can be found also. Like you said, there are maybe not many, but in Finland, and we can find them also in Poland and Baltics too. So no matter how much we know about this fact that there is disinformation, there are still a lot of people who spread it also in here, in this region. Yeah,
yeah. And when you look at what Russia is doing right now, ramping up their hybrid operations, for example, there was sabotage operation in this Gotland island in Sweden, where they messed with the water system and all these like cable cuts. I think there wasn't there one between Latvia and Sweden also. All these kind of that seem to be like there's so much of them happening right now. It seems quite suspicious, at least. So there's so much happening. I think there were even in Finland there were like few water towers that were broken into. I think, yeah. So what we should be kind of wary of right now are also these hybrid operations, because Russia is too weak to wage war on several fronts like conventional war, but they are still very good at doing these sabotage operations, hybrid operations, and not even disinformation propaganda, of course.
And I noticed that you have also written about at least one Latvian, more precisely about Tatiana Zhdanov, who was a member of the European Parliament for a long time ago, and then for a long time, and who I would say sadly is also well known to us Latvians. Can you remember some work that you did on our country? Do you remember something? I know this information flow every day is pretty huge for you.
This year I will do more focused work in the Baltics and also in Latvia. So I am kind of looking for examples, but getting to know the cultural environment and the politics and so on in a country takes a while. So right now I'm still doing background research and some investigations and talking with people from your country so that we can do as accurate reporting as possible. But definitely there will be more work done about Latvia in this year.
And you also comment on political developments. So I'd like to ask, what do you think about the current security situation in Europe? Where are we now and where are we heading in the context of these Trump policies and the ceasefire talks and everything? Yeah,
I think Trump will continue pushing for this kind of forced peace on Ukraine, which is basically a capitulation. It doesn't really look good. I hope that the big European countries would ramp up their support for Ukraine. When you look at the bilateral aid coming from countries like France and Italy, or Spain, it's not much that they are sending, honestly speaking. So there's a lot of talk, but not that much action. If we want to fully commit to defending Europe, we have to support Ukraine as much as we can. And I feel like there are countries that have been involved in wars and have been part of the Soviet Union, for example. These countries understand the severity of the problem, but other countries like this, the old Europe, doesn't really still understand the severity. So now would be the time to provide Ukraine with all the assistance that they need. And it seems that it has to come from Europe. So we just have to start acting fast.
Okay, thank you. It was nice talking to you. And thank you for the work that you do. And let's hope that less and less people will fall in this Kremlin disinformation web. Let's call it like that.
Thank you. It was a good talk. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Raidieraksts drošinātājs.
Paldies Rihardam un mūsu viesim Pekam Kalioniemi no Somijas, Vatņiku zupas galvenajam pavāram, cilvēkam, kurš atmasko Krievijas propagandas nesējas pasaulē. Tā izskaitā Latvijā, jā. Starp citu, tas bija ļoti ieintriģējoši, kad Pek stāstīja, ka nu pat ir tikai pievērsies arī Latvijai, Baltijai, mūsu reģionam. Iedrošina arī tas, ka, kā mēs dzirdējām, viņš gatavojas, jo vēlas izpētīt situāciju kārtīgāk. Tātad šis nav tas gadījums, kad tiek izbļauts kaut kāds viens sauklis vai viens nosaukts par propagandistu, otrs nosaukts par sarkano propagandistu vai vēl kaut ko un viss lieta darīt. Pek tiešām iedziļinās tajā, ko raksta. Arī es viņam sekoju jau kādu laiku līdz, un ja arī jūs to darījāt, tad jums noteikti bija divi tik interesanti, bet ja kādu zinat aktīvu Twitteristu vai kādu citu sociālo mediju lietotāju, tad es ieteiktu aizsūtīt saiti uz šo interviju tam cilvēkam, un tas cilvēks noteikti novērtēs to, ka padalījāties ar to. Droši mums varat arī rakstīt atsauksmes tajos pašos sociālajos mēdījos, lietojiet Mirkļa Birku drošinātājs, tāpat arī varat mums rakstīt vēstules, lai ieteiktu kādus citus viesus vai tēmas, ar ko mums pārspriest ar Kristīni. E-pasta adrese nemainīgi, drošinātājs at Latvijas Radio LV. Un ja jūs šī te propagandas tēma interesē, tad patiesību sakot, sanāca tā, es pat teiktu gandrīz neplānoti, ka pēdējā pusotra mēneša laikā šī jau mums ir trešā saruna par Krievijas propagandu dažādos tās aspektos. Ja tas jūs interesē, tad arī mūsu 102. Epizodē ir saruna ar Viktoru Berzenko, ukraiņu politologu un pētnieku, kurš runā par metodēm, kādas Krievija izmanto savas propagandas bīdīšanai, un savukārt 104. Epizodē mēs runājām, kā kartes tiek izmantotas, veicinot Krievijas propagandas kaut kādas vēstījumus. Bet katrā ziņā, jā, droši klausieties arī mūsu iepriekšējās intervijas. Nu jau tātad mums ir 107 mūsu krājumā. Tās lielāko ties ir tādas, kas ļoti ātri nenoveco, tā kā ir interesantas un izglītojošas un informējošas arī pēc kāda laika. Droši klausieties, dalieties un sūtiet mums vēstules, lai mēs zinām, ka neesam šai pasaulē vieni.
Un droši arī lasiet mūsu intervijas portālā lsm.lv nedēļas nogalē, tās tur var atrast, arī, protams, šo ar Peku Kalioniemī varēsiet atrast, un jūs, kā jau divas minēja, interesē šis temats, sakojiet viņam, meklējiet viņu sociālajos medijos, YouTube, X un viskaut kur citur, vai arī nopērciet angļu valodā grāmatu, un tiem, kuriem varbūt ar angļu valodu grūtāk, nu, jāceru un jāgaida uz grāmatu latviešu valodā.
Nu jā, un ja jūs esat grāmatu izdevējs, tad nu jau tātad divi no trim cilvēkiem, kuri pie mums ir runājuši par propagandu, piedāvā savus grāmatas publicēt arī latviešu valodā un Latvijā. Tā kā, ja jums vajag kontaktus, rakstiet mums drošinātājs at Latvijas Radio LV, un mēs jūs noteikti savedīsim kopā. Bet nu gan, tas šā reizē viss. Paldies, ka klausījāties. Līdz nākamajai nedēļai.
Visu labu! Drošinātājs skaidri un personīgi par karu Ukrainā.
Raidieraksts drošinātājs.